of to certain communities, because if you are part, if I mean, one word is like one person, Rachel Dolezal, you know, if you actually would have been part of a Black community, it would have never been possible for you to backstab an entire community in that sense by centering yourself so much and you know, taking up so much space in a ridiculous kind of way, because your Black community would have held you accountable. And we definitely will call you out. Mm-hmm. Well, so, and I think this is something that I really always mention when it comes to this. Thank you also, Niloufar, for also opening up this realm of this idea of romanticization. I don't only think it works with ideas of home, or in other words, or motherland, but it also works with terms or, let's say, ideas of community, you know. Let me elaborate on that. The one thing that happens often is that we have an idea of what community means, and that we sometimes are not very careful around this idea of community. Some aspects are aspects like, you know, self-exploitation, or also aspects of not having intersectional intentions. I will not say knowledge, because knowledge is situated. And of course, this is also a very academic way of, yeah, you just have to have the knowledge in order to have some sort of in order to act in a good manner. So this is not what I'm not interested in, that kind of ideas. But what I'm interested in definitely is that we have to have intentions to understand the complexities that are accompanying us as people when we come together. So, and then to the next idea, when we are talking about community, it is a verb, you know, and this is something that sometimes doesn't, people sometimes do not understand what that means. It means that your collective ideas and your collective actions build something that can cater to a community or not. And there is an important point also that you mentioned, Marilyn, about diasporic communities. I mean, you specifically talked about digital communities. And there is something that is interesting, because there is some sort of an idea that it has to be this cozy bubble, right? It's this cozy or cloud-like cotton candy thing that is a community. But of course, it is not. And it never had been, because especially when we talk about communities beyond border, this has always been part of it, that we have an opportunity to be mobile in our thoughts, even though if we might not always be with our bodies. And when I say this, I mean we have to make an effort to really reach out to different kinds of individuals, but also to different kinds of communities, by understanding their possibilities of mobility. And I'm specifically talking about people who get disabled in an ableist society, for instance, when it's about this idea of collective organization. Yes, we have to think how can we not be ableist by thinking, well, we can only organize in a physical manner, right? And this is something that I really appreciate when people are vocal about these kind of ideas. And also it comes to conclude, also it comes to some sort of an agency there and also to responsibility with our siblings and sisters who aren't, you know, physically living in Switzerland or in the global north. And what that creates, it creates an idea that we have this accountability.
I'd like to kind of like maybe pick up a little bit more on that, because you both talked about, you know, first of all, taking responsibility, you know, you talked about the complexities that kind of like also, you know, surface when you come to translate, you know, a movement, when you come to take a movement to another place. What do you pick? You know, every translation, basically something gets lost. And how are you aware of that? And what do you pick and what do you make work for you? And, you know, in my practice, I don't know how it is for you, but in my practice, a lot of time when we kind of like want to say that, you know, we want to do it differently than it has been done, we kind of like say we're going to queer it, you know? So, I kind of like want to ask you for Permagic, like if I would, you know, how can we queer communities? Like how can we queer communities, but moreover also, how do we make sure that when we're doing that, when we're queering community building, that we're not also actually building up new queer normatives? You know, like what would that mean for you?
Wow, that's an amazing question. I don't know, honestly. I wouldn't know how we could not recreate new queer norms. I think queering communities can mean to alter certain also queer scripts. And there are many ways to do that. And I would say it also really often starts within. This urge to kind of have this idea that you have to be very proactively manipulating your surroundings on the outside might not even be the most radical thing. Sometimes it really is through this work within yourself. And queering communities has also this aspect of understanding that it will create a new normal. And then being, whenever it took momentum, being aware of how, if ever, we slipped into this kind of same lines of having created new norms. When it comes to this idea of how we want to queer spaces or queer communities, I think it's an important question to ask ourselves what purpose lies within the actual state, you know, and having the freedom and also be brave enough to completely overrule the ideas that have been prevalent if they're not serving all those members who should be part of this community. And this certainly is something that happens in queer communities and also in communities that have been queered, because, mm-hmm. of course, it doesn't mean that they are always queer communities.
Yeah, absolutely. Niloufar, can you relate to that? Or?
I also agree. This is a really great question. And I think it's a question that I think there's also an implication, because we know that, especially, you know, with so many like terms, there's always like something washing happening, right? So it's also, there's this thing that we are claiming to queer stuff, but all our claims could be also washed. What I want to actually mention, I want to a bit like sit together with the how we even define the word queer, what does it mean, and how much we want to be playful for it, with that. And you began by quoting bell hooks, and for me, in defining the word queer, I really like the way that bell hooks defines it. That she says that queer not as being a person or not as about who you're having sex with, but as the constant state of being at odds with everything in the world. I really like this definition that she brings. And in my head, I can a bit also like relate it to one of the talks that James Baldwin was giving. It's called On the Struggle. And he starts his conversation that how deep he's mistrusting so many words. He starts by talking that he does not even know what the word artist, what the word art, what the word writing even means. I very much relate with this constant mistrust with the words, especially with the terms, right? For example, we hear the term intersectionality. Mm-hmm. The point is that what it means, and even if the word is like thrown on the table, what it's really doing for whom and how much it is doing, like compared to how much it's claiming, I think. Again, going back to both of them, to bell hooks and James Baldwin, what I think, I mean, if we really want to resist to our all of our generational and collective and historical struggles not to be taken from us, not to be washed, I think it's really important to be be comfortable with being constantly uncomfortable with so many ideas, right? Never being, as you were saying, you know, never being satisfied. It does not mean just to do self-harm. It means understanding that the moment that we start to take it easy, like the moment that we hear the word queer somewhere and we think that the word is just going to do the job, it's the moment that we start to lose something. And if you want to also look, we can like have a look at how from 60s and 70s onward, how when the language of neoliberalism was advancing in the world, what it happened to the word feminism, right? Of course, feminism, by the word feminism, I mean the one that was developed in France and globalness. From the very beginning, it was racist. From the very beginning, it was a tool in the hand of many forces of colonization. But what happened in this turn of 60s and 70s and onward, it was that suddenly so many corporate and so many capitalist centers and neoliberalist states, they started investing in quote-unquote feminist ideas, to the extent that at the moment the politicians who are responsible for a genocide happening in Gaza, they call themselves feminist. So it's, again, I think I would like to a bit, maybe this is my proposal, but again, trying to talk together with bell hooks and James Baldwin and so many other people, I think this mistrust is very important to hold it, right? Again, being comfortable with refusing and holding this disbelief.
I like that idea, you know, because I think, as you say, it's fundamental. But you know, when you say like, we kind of have to feel, you know, like we kind of have to be content, or we kind of have to feel okay with never being satisfied. Well, you know, in my heart I felt it, but in my tummy I was like, but that's so exhausting, you know. So how are we gonna, you know? Then I would kind of like be okay, but how do we make sure that in this constant, you know, aim of being willing to acknowledge that we cannot grow, actually, if we're not willing to be constantly in a transformative state, you know, so there is no growing happening, there's actually just stagnation. How do we still make sure, you know, that we create communities that still allow us to actually feel like we're okay, like this is okay, you know? Like, does my question make sense? Like, how do you make sure that you're not, you know, how do you make sure that you're not getting exhausted?
I mean, that's of course a very important point. And
you know that, yeah. I think that's my question, actually.
No, it's a very important question, but I think it really depends who that we is. There's a very big difference between ethnic minority in, for example, in the context of Iran. There's a very big difference between group of Baluchi women. It's one of the most marginalized parts of Iran, coming together and doing something than Iranian diasporic people here in Zurich. These two V are not the same. And there, I think the whole language should also be different, right? And as you say, of course, there's always this exhaustion because we cannot deny that we are living in either in late capitalist or in neoliberalist world. And this exhaustion also has to do the way that time is capitalized, right? We can, but at the end, we cannot distance ourselves with this reality. And always the most marginalized or the most racialized or bodies, they are the one who not only are carrying their own fatigues, but also generational fatigue. I think that's also something, you know. In the case of Iran, in the case of the Arab region, who some of the countries, they spend so much, for example, in the case of, for example, Syria, right? The so-called Arab Spring happened, but it didn't win the way that people wished for. That is also another fatigue that people are still holding over their shoulders after more than 10 years. So these things, of course, exist, and I think I cannot also claim that I have a specific answer to that. But what I feel is that together with this exhaustion, there's always also a very radical joy because this constant and collective refusal is part of the language of self-determination. Mm-hmm. Right? It is, that's how I'm mentioning by this constant refusal. It is not just to make myself clear, it is not just saying no for the sake of saying no. It is not conforming to the easiest thing, but just going back and trying to determine our, not only future, not only present, but also our past. And I think this part of this collective joy, you know, it's even if our very radical freedom dreams, even if they are going to fail, we know that we witness what was or what is happening to us, but we said no. And there is something very beautiful and very powerful in that.
I want to come back to joy later, but maybe for Pamagic, you want to say something about exhaustion?
It's I would probably say story of a of our mutual lives, but I would really like to pick up on something that Niloufar said about how actually it is part of whitewashing different movements. So in neoliberalism, for instance, we see some sort of exploitation in this so-called or hashtag girl boss movements, right? So the people who are who work like 60 hours a week also do like all the reproductive work at home also find a lot of joy in also going to the gym 5 times a week. And this all under this umbrella of, well, we are self-determined because we have reached sort of a feminist self-determined life because we're emancipated. So now we do it all. And I think how to not be exhausted could be acknowledging that all those kind of different aspects are actually by design. We are meant to feel and think that if we hold up to this kind of level of productivity, that we then will get recognition. It will never happen, not under the realm of this exploitative systems. And when it, how it intersects also with, also I would even say, or call this the gentrification of movements, is also, for instance, how certain cultural codes have been replicated in a very specific way. For instance, this Yas Queen, right? So how this idea that this is and it can be stripped of its blackness and then it's just queer, right? It doesn't happen and doesn't work like that. And I think this is also some sort of a collective exhaustion, having to always do the educational labor around those codes and teaching people also how you explained where actually this movement came from, and also the Kurdish roots of the movement, and stripping it away from that, and always having to do those extra loops by explaining how it actually came to be, where it's rooted, and what it means, can sometimes feel very disenfranchises the people. And I would take a step back and then really sit in this moment and understanding and also scrutinizing spaces, as I also said here. I'm coming into a warm space. I'm saying this because I do not have to explain myself. I do not have to explain my humanity and my identity. I can just arrive. And also, I know I do not have to do those extra loops by making people understand that some certain ideas have been replicas, and that this itself is a violence. Also, when it comes to restitution and all those aspects, where when we talk about artifacts and also cultural and mental goods, right, that have been displaced or that are being destroyed in this very moment, acknowledging this and not accepting that, this kind of resistance is what can help to kind of push back against this constant exhaustion. And to also, you in your initial question, you asked something about how to kind of navigate all those things. I think exhaustion and is a very specific idea of having overdone the work. But I think at this point, it's very also important to acknowledge that if we just are, we have stopped becoming. And I would really like to also push through this idea that it's not about, you know, staying still and being content and just resting in a state of this cozy cotton candy that I mentioned, but to understanding that maybe the pace has to be adjusted, but that we should aspire to become and not just to be. But that is not equal to produce, right? So, and there, I think, is a very important, also communal strength in refusing to be in a certain neoliberal sense productive. It definitely will not mean that you will stop, become, and also move towards utopian states where we would want to head to. And also living this and modeling this and having people close so they can actually see and feel and experience you, how you do that is a very beautiful and precious thing. And I think it will help us. And that's why I always tell people, live your ways of how you want to become, and live your ways in how you navigate those things, because you will not, there is no winning, you know, in girl bossing. It will never happen.
Yeah, really, I really like, thank you so much for that idea for Pamagic. I really like that idea of you know, building of reinventing actually really fluidity, of building fluid communities, you know, of building transformative communities. Niloufar, you got me stuck on joy there when you mentioned joy. I was maybe for the last part of this series tonight, I really also kind of like want us to move there. In queer and big community spaces, care in itself has been valued and practiced long before it actually was theorized, you know, and because, you know, queer people and trans people of color have been excluded from traditional care systems. And during the 1960s and the 1970s, trans people, particularly Black trans women, experienced disappropriated rates of housing instability due to society's vilification of trans people. And I mean, it's not in the past, you know, until today, trans youth is becoming more likely to be homeless because of familial or community rejection within their own, you know, community. And however, in the 60s, there was an emergence of so-called houses. And in the queer and trans community, and houses functioned as an alternative family, actually. They primarily consisted of Black and Latinx, queer and trans people, and provided shelter for those who feel ostracized by governmental support systems. And they were led by mothers, or sometimes fathers, who will provide guidance and support and care to their house children. And the children of the houses were seeing each other as siblings, right? And for me, this is such a beautiful example of how we can redefine ourselves within a community, you know, especially when we cannot depend on the traditional heteronormative family system as well to receive care due to rejection. And so for me, care, especially community care in all its aspects, then becomes really central. Like, how do we care for ours, right? And despite this, I think we are not immune to the, as you know, Niloufar, as you said, like individualistic vision of neoliberal capitalist societies in which we grow up and live. And so to reflect upon our current practices and to see the real extent of care principle in our spaces seems really important for me. And so to maybe, you know, enter the last part of this episode, I'm going to quote I'm going to quote JJ Wright again, who writes in their book Celebrating Queer Joy that queer joy flies in the face of cis heteronormativity. So it's framed always in that frame. And they write, "We will not buy into this toxic power dynamics. We will not live our lives according to these societal confines around gender roles and sexual norms. But instead, we will live in ways that are about connectivity, about humanity, pleasure, and reciprocity." And this quote really speaks so much to me because this quote actually for me kind of like holds this whole line of like, how do we make sure that we actually, you know, when we are building communities, that we actually still live in joy and pleasure, and that never goes, you know, that we never lose that. You know, maybe Nilo.
I can pick on that. I think the way that I see the questions around care, joy, for me and from the place that I'm coming from and for the place that I have total dedication to talk about, only hearing the word queer before care does not explain enough. Similar to other words, right? Like, for example, similar to the word feminist, that for so many of us, if we need so many adjectives to come before these words just to make sure that they are going to give us liberatory tools, especially against our capitalist world, which is defining itself through mass murder tools of like violence, with the thing that has happened to Afghanistan, the thing that has happened to in Iraq, Syria, and Palestine. What I want to say by this is that with the quote that you just mentioned, exactly, we start by refusing collectively. We start to refuse these interconnected systems of oppression, and we want to imagine